This is a podcast from the University of Manchester's Jodrell Bank Centre for Astrophysics. For more information, see jodcast.net.
Joining us on the Jodcast today is Dr. Simon Green from the Open University, and you've been giving a talk about the Stardust NEXT mission, Enduring Now. Can you tell us what is the Stardust NEXT mission and what have you been finding?
Yes, the mission is actually a follow-on mission from the original Stardust mission, which was designed to collect a sample from comet Vil-2 and return it to the Earth, which it did in 2006. After the end of that mission, the main mother spacecraft flew past the Earth, and it was then redirected and renamed Stardust NEXT, targeted towards comet Tempel-1. Now, this comet was the one which another mission called Deep Impact fired a projectile into a few years earlier. And the main objective of the Stardust NEXT mission was to look at the changes in the nature of the comet between the time of the two spacecraft encounters, and also to try and see if it could see the crater that the projectile from the previous mission had done. But my interest is actually in dust detectors on board the spacecraft. And these were there to monitor the amount of dust particles hitting the spacecraft, because we needed to know that at the original Vil-2 encounter to allow us to predict how many particles would be present in the aerogel, the collectors that were returned to the Earth for detailed laboratory analysis.
So people familiar with BBC Stargazing Live, they had a piece of aerogel on their TV show. It's a very, very light particle. So if people would say that that's the type of detector that you use to detect dust particles?
Well, the aerogel was to collect them. So this is extremely low-density glass. It's like, imagine it's like a glass sponge with a density of about 1,000 times less than water. So very, very low density. And the idea is it decelerates the dust grains relatively slowly. Spacecraft, as it's flying past the comet at 6 kilometres a second, would be completely destroy the grains when it hit a target, unless you can slow them down gradually. So the idea was to go get a sample return on the cheap by collecting these things as you flew past. Our experiment was actually on the front shield of the spacecraft, detecting the impacts as the particles hit the spacecraft, not the ones that were collected, other particles, and they produce vibrations in the front shield, which we picked up with very sensitive microphones. And those allowed us to record the timing of events as we flew through the comet to say when the particles were collected, because the collector doesn't have any time information, it just has the final collection. So we had time resolution of the throughout the encounter.
So how close to the comet did you go? Did you fly all the way through the tail of the comet? How
went through the coma, that's the head of the comet, so much, much closer than when you observe from the Earth and you see a comet, you see an extended cloud of gas, which is called the coma, with the tail coming out of that. So if, as viewed from the Earth, we went right through the centre, so within around 200 kilometres of the nucleus, that's the few miles wide icy ball at the centre. So very, very close to it. So the idea was to get into the region where the dust grains are, the density of dust grains is high enough to collect enough to bring back. So it's very dangerous because the targeting of the spacecraft was very critical. If you missed a little bit too much, you'd go too close to the nucleus, you could be hit by a several centimetre-sized grain that would have destroyed the spacecraft. Too far away, we wouldn't collect anything. And there was a very, very critical narrow window which we had to hit, which fortunately we did.
Twice,
yes.
Twice. I take it that's involved a lot of calculations then to try and get that precise area
where to hit. Yes, and a lot of sleepless nights for the engineers. And, of course, the scientists were all fighting the engineers. The engineers want to go a long way away to preserve their spacecraft. The scientists want to go very close to collect lots of particles. And we sort of met somewhere in between. And unfortunately, we did achieve the main objectives. And the sample analysis is going to be ongoing for many decades to come. They're really incredibly interesting results. My interest, as I say, was in the direct detection. So what I was talking about today was comparing the results from the Vil-2 encounter in 2004 with the Tempel-1 encounter last year. And this is the first time ever that you had a spacecraft with the same instruments that flew past two different comets. And because we had such unusual results, which frankly, a number of people didn't trust. We really wanted to see whether we could confirm that in a second comet.
So what was so unusual about your results?
Well, you would expect as you flew past a comet which is producing lots of dust, which comes out from the ices in the nucleus. When the nucleus comes close to the sun, the ices get heated, vaporize, and drag the dust away from the comet with them, and that's what we're collecting. You'd expect that to be a fairly sort of uniform distribution. So as you flew into the coma, the count rates, the number of impacts you detected would gradually rise to a peak as you got to closest approach and then gradually fall away again. And that wasn't at all what happened. What we found was that we had huge bursts of many, many impacts in shorter than the time resolution of the experiment, which was a tenth of a second. And in one case, over 1,000 impacts in a tenth of a second. And then for 14 seconds preceding that, not a single one. And that was right at closest approach for VIL-2. Absolutely astonishing. So we had orders of magnitude, many thousand times changes in the spatial density of the particles from different locations. And the only way we could really understand that was if the dust grains leaving the comet were breaking up, so fragmenting. And so you had a little cloud of dust grains that gradually expands, and then by chance you fly through it. So all the time when you're detecting nothing, you're missing these expanding clouds, and then when you fly through one, you see a huge burst of activity, and then it drops down to zero again for a little while until you hit another one. And we saw the same thing at Temple 1. Now, this has not very much implication for people who are observing comets from the ground, because they're seeing on spatial scales of many tens of thousands of kilometers, where all these little fragmenting grains of all kind of clouds have spread out into each other, and it just looks like a uniform comet, which is what we see. But it matters if you're really close to the comet, because what's going to happen in a few years' time is Rosetta, the European Space Agency's comet mission, which is going to go into orbit around a comet, not fly past, and put a lander on the surface, is going to be orbiting in this region.
Oh, wow.
Very close to the... Yeah. And, of course, when the lander is put down, the comet will be a long way from the sun and not very active, so that's not going to be dangerous then. But the orbiter itself is going to be following the comet in towards the sun. And, of course, gradually it will move away, always trying to be at a safe distance. But of course, it's going to be the same quandary. The scientists are going to be wanting to keep close because that's the exciting bit. The engineers are going to say, be further away. But their calculations will be based on our old idea of a kind of average coma. And if it's not like that, if it's like we've seen in these two comets, from which I believe it will be, then they're going to have to be very, very careful, because if they fly through one of these expanding dust clouds, they'll get 1,000 times the number of impacts that they thought they were going to get. So it's going to be quite interesting doing that manoeuvring around the comet.
So you're going to get very high density pockets and then nothing, empty.
That's correct, yes.
And what will cause this expanding dust clouds in these comets?
Well, what happens with the comet itself, of course, it's the activity is driven by ices, that are so mostly water ice, that are being heated by the sun. When you go in, they vaporize, and so that drags off dust particles. So the old idea was you had a whole range of sizes of dust particles which reflected aggregates of original interstellar grains that might be as small as a fraction of a micron that are produced in the atmospheres of stars, and then traveling the interstellar medium, they maybe collect organic, so carbon molecular clusters around them in interstellar clouds, and eventually they arrive in the pre-solar nebula, so before the solar system's fully formed, and they start clumping together, and this stuff is what you make comets out of in the outer solar system. Now, that sort of view has comets as being made up of these fluffy aggregates of grains. And so you might have pieces of this coming away and then something heating, maybe it's the organic glue that's sticking together some more rigid particles, making them come apart.
So by organic glue, do you mean water or do you mean
something else? No, not water. It would be some kind of carbon molecules, but... certainly not things that would vaporize at low temperatures, so it won't be water-based things or methane or ammonia, that kind of thing. It would be long-chain organic molecules, the kinds of things that we're starting to see in the interstellar medium. Yes, yeah. So if you have that kind of thing, then you could sort of imagine that glue kind of loosening as the grains leave the comet. Because one of the characteristics of dust grains is that they're very small grains, they get superheated because they can't emit infrared radiation very much. So as they leave the comet, they get hotter. And so that may just be enough to trigger this fragmentation process. And we all thought, well, this is a kind of nice little picture that we've built up until samples are analysed. And it was the last talk you heard today was talking about the samples that have been analysed by the geochemists. And what we didn't see, that we were expecting to see, was this really primitive, fragile kind of material that we would expect to come from interstellar grains glued together, that survived the heating in the early solar nebula. What they actually found was grains that appeared to have been formed at very high temperatures, over 1,000 degrees, which we would have expected right at the middle of the pre-solar nebula. And somehow that has to get transported out to the region of comets and then buried in comets. And of course that then leaves us with, well, if that's what we're the dust in comets is made of and that we were detecting on our spacecraft, it has to be the same stuff, it was collected from the same mission, how then do we fragment those when they're really rigid high-temperature grains? So there's a lot of questions still to be answered, and I think it's going to be some time before we really understand it. Maybe it will take the Rosetta instruments where we can hang around for a long time around the comet and really observe it to understand exactly what's happening.
How long will the Rosetta instrument go around the comet for? Will it go through an entire orbit, or will it just be as part of it?
Many, many orbits. The idea is that they will arrive at the comet and have a reconnaissance, so map the surface and decide where they're going to put the lander. The lander will go down, sample the nucleus and make measurements, detailed measurements of the ices and the dust grains, the composition. Whereas the orbiter also has compositional measurements, but the dust detector is very different from the one that we developed for Stardust because it's slow speed. Because it's in orbit, the particles will impact at meters per second, not kilometers per second. And so they will use optical techniques to detect them. So as particles fly into a box, you'll see a light shining and the particles will cause a flash and you can measure the size of the particles that way. But I think the answer is more likely to come from the lander, where we can really see what the stuff on the surface of the comet was made of close up. You know, imaging at scales of millimeters is what's really required for this. And there's also a microscope in the orbiter, atomic force microscope, which will measure individual dust grains at extremely high magnifications that it's collected in the coma. I think those are the things that will tell us ultimately what's going on, because of course whatever you do when you make a measurement in from a comet from ground-based observations is you're sampling the daughter products of whatever process got them out of the original comet out into the coma where you can see them. And of course they're the end product of all these processes that we don't fully understand. Stardust was kind of got halfway to that, because it allows us to study these things in detail in the lab, but they're still the products of whatever process got the dust grains out. If we, with Rosetta, we'll actually be able to get to the source, which is going to be fantastic.
Well, it sounds like a very interesting new mission. I can't wait to see the results from it. Thank you very much for talking to us today.